The fate of 30 million people is now in the hands of a newly empowered, ruthless Marxist dictator in the once great nation of Venezuela, now becoming a hellhole. Why should Americans care? Find out now on The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are The Uprising, with Scott Cosenza and Tim Donner.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
Hey, a president. Can you believe it?
I love the poorly educated.
The voters have guaranteed themselves slavery, economic disaster.
I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
Lordy, I hope there are tapes.
I have never met with Russians.
Putin is continuing to advance into
Korea.
Gee, it's amazing that the Russians have been able to influence four special elections.
This is The Uprising, the podcast of LibertyNation.com. Tim Donner with you this week and joined by Liberty Nation's military and foreign affairs correspondent Nathan Steelwater to discuss how things have reached crisis proportions in Venezuela following a consolidation of power by the Marxist president turned outright dictator Nicolas Maduro after he ordered up elections widely considered fraudulent, which will overturn the Venezuelan constitution and grant de facto absolute power to Mr. Maduro, who one day after the elections ordered his political opponents dragged out of bed in the middle of the night and arrested as the nation literally burns. So, Nathan, thanks for joining in today and answer me, just how bad are things down in Venezuela?
Well, they're quite bad. For one, Venezuela has the highest inflation rate in the world. That's about 741% inflation right now. And here's the thing. In 1950, Venezuela had the fourth highest GDP per capita in the world. And right now, they have the highest inflation rate. There are rampant shortages of food and basic medical supplies, rolling blackouts that happen sporadically, and you have a government who is ignoring the protests of its people, is ignoring the Congress, which is controlled by the opposition, and has pushed forward a new constitutional electing body, a constituent assembly, to rewrite the Constitution in his favor to consolidate and further hold on to that power.
Well, now, Nathan, when we're talking about Venezuela, we're not talking about a third world banana republic like people might consider it to be. I mean, did Venezuela not have a proud and prosperous history before the reign of Hugo Chavez and Mr. Maduro, who by the way, began his career as a bus driver?
Well, Venezuela was at one time a poverty-stricken banana republic. And in the article that I wrote, Venezuela, Poster Child for Socialism Hell, which is on the website, it breaks down generally the history of Venezuela. Now, oil was discovered in the early 20th century, and they quickly rose to economic success. Now, the period of time that they had their greatest success was unfortunately under a politically repressive rule. So Venezuela, while it has been economically prosperous, has bounced back and forth between dictators and socialism, so dictators of another kind. And I mean, they've been fairly prosperous, but unfortunately, when you have decades of socialist policy and central economic planning on the government level, you know, consistent attempts to undermine property rights, continue to make the state the one who runs the economy, you're going to have problems, and especially since Venezuela is not a banana republic, it's a petrostate. Its entire economy is reliant on oil. And so they suffered from what's called Dutch disease, which is when one sector progresses, but the others decay. And that's what happens when you have state control and they put all their eggs into one oil-filled basket.
Well, let's take this back a step from Nicolas Maduro to Hugo Chavez, who set Venezuela on this, I guess the best way you could put it would be progressive direction when he consolidated power in the 1990s. How was this Marxist radical Chavez able to come to power in the first place?
Sure. So Chavez was not the first Marxist, socialist, what have you, to run Venezuela. Right after the coup in 1958 that overthrew Marcos Perez Jimenez, that repressive dictator, a man by the name of Romulo Bentecourt took over as president. And he was an ex-communist. He pushed them towards democracy, but he also pushed them towards socialism. So the seeds of socialism had been planted long before Chavez. But Chavez had tried to take power several times. In the early 90s, he led a botched coup. He went to jail. He was eventually released if they promised to leave the army. His military officers with close ties tried a second coup attempt while he was in jail. He visited Cuba a bunch of times, where, of course, that informed some of his political ideology. And in the late 90s, he won the presidential election. And the reason that he won that is because you had some of the failed policies from his predecessors and you on the socialist side, and you had failed policies from their predecessors on the extreme, you know, corrupt and crony capitalist side. So Chavez appealed to the lower middle class and the working class and basically said, we're going to find a third way, you know, between these two, and we're going to do some social welfare programs. And he basically, he promised change is what he did, but he promised change that would appeal to the masses by doing more social welfare programs. And that's one of the things that I echo in the article that I previously mentioned, that this is how socialist revolutionaries come to power, is they promise a bunch of benefits for the people, and then they use those to make those people reliant on the state, further consolidating that power.
Well, let's talk about why Americans should care about what goes on in Venezuela. And one of the reasons is that it is an assault on democracy, plain and simple. I mean, these phony constituent assembly elections which were held, which you know, with widespread reports that many were threatened into voting, this constituent assembly will have the authority to change the constitution of 18 years ago to essentially get rid of the opposition-controlled legislature, which was voted on in 2015, and potentially keep Maduro in power indefinitely. What kind of effect could this have politically on the U.S., considering how dependent we are? Maybe I wouldn't use the word dependent, but the fact that the U.S. is Venezuela's biggest client for the petro part of the petro state, because they sit on the world's largest supply of oil reserves.
They do sit on the world's largest supply of oil reserves. Of course, they're not managing it very well. And at least
that's an understatement.
Numbers, exactly. They don't manage it well at all, and that's why they're where they are now. But 2016 numbers show that the United States, about 8% of our gross imports of petroleum came from Venezuela, and net imports is about 72. Now, when we say petroleum, we're also talking about petroleum products in general. On the economic side, refineries in the United States are starting to push away from what's called heavy crude. So when it comes to oil, you've got heavy crude, you've got sour crude, you've got light crude, and you've got sweet crude. And basically the idea is, you know, heavier sour crudes have more impurities. They're harder to refine, takes more effort. And so U.S. refiners have already started shifting away from processing those heavier sour crudes, and that's to help, you know, kind of give a little buffer from any impact on disruption of, you know, Venezuelan imports, because 8% of our oil does come from Venezuela, at least in 2016. But politically, I think the biggest reason that Americans need to pay attention to Venezuela is it is the supreme warning we can have about what happens when you allow socialism to prosper. You know, and it's not an overnight thing. Socialism crept into Venezuela a long time ago, and it planted its seeds, and like a weed, it spread. And now we're facing the chickens have come home to roost, essentially. You know, so it's not like if we turn socialist overnight, this will happen. But this is what we can see in the future. It's almost a longitudinal study, if you will.
Well, let me play devil's advocate a bit on the larger geopolitical picture. There is what they call the ALBA, A-L-B-A, block of 11 Caribbean and Latin American countries, that all follow a statist, leftist, collectivist, Marxist, whatever you want to call it, philosophy of government. That includes Cuba, of course, and Bolivia and Ecuador and Nicaragua. And yet Latin America's shifted away where they had before this, shifted away from that kind of leftist populism towards a more sort of centrist, the type of centrist policies that are more comfortable, of course, for people in the United States. And so that block of nations has dwindled a bit. They've lost Argentina and Brazil, for example. So does this really represent any kind of trend in South and Latin America?
I don't know if I'm comfortable saying that it represents a trend. I mean, obviously, you know, the trend that you see with socialism in general is that socialism works when you add capitalism to it. You know, socialism works when it's not socialism, when it's capitalism light is the only way that socialism really works. And that's what you see in the Nordic states. You know, they're quote-unquote democratic socialism, but they still have very free markets. You know, Venezuela shows us what happens when you have state control of the economy, and it shows us what happens when you have people who don't really know what they're doing making those economic decisions. It's essentially all of the complaints that people have about crony capitalism, except it's crony socialism. And you look at the constituent assembly that, you know, election that Venezuela just had, Maduro's wife and child are on the assembly.
Well, that doesn't necessarily mean they'll vote for him. I mean, maybe they don't have a good marriage. I'm just kidding. I mean, I'm trying to bring a little levity to a situation which, Nathan, is really causing almost inconceivable suffering, because we talk about the political elements of what's going on in Venezuela, the larger geopolitical picture, but the suffering of this nation of 30 million people. There's rampant inflation, as you pointed out, incredibly high food prices, the highest inflation rate in the world. People can't eat. I note that they've dubbed this phenomenon the Maduro diet, because there's simply no food to eat. They can't even get goods as basic as toilet paper, medical supplies. I mean, this is a situation that can't be sustainable, can it?
No, it's a death spiral is exactly what it is. What we are seeing, if there's not significant change soon, is these are the carrion calls for Venezuela. You can't have a country last like that if, you know, you have constant shortage of supplies. You have an economy that is worthless. So, fun fact, and I mentioned this in the last article that I posted about the henchmen dragging opposition leaders from their houses. The in-game currency for World of Warcraft currently has a higher value than the Venezuelan Bolivar.
Well,
like that's how bad
that's
the economy
bad
in
is.
Venezuela
yeah.
is right now. That a non-existent, you know, completely fake currency whose inflation rate is created by the continuous spawning of you know, online enemies, it currently has a higher value than the currency of the largest oil reservoir in the world. You know, it's insane just the amount of suffering and the amount of collapse that this country is going to. And all the while, Maduro is trying to just simply maintain more power. And what's even more bananas is that he has supporters in that country. He has a body that is supporting him, and that's why all of these protests have been marred by violence.
Well, he's getting support internationally, too. I mean, no less than Jeremy Corbyn, who did surprisingly well in the British elections, has criticized the U.S., for labeling Maduro for what he is, a dictator. And you've got international figures like Corbyn actually defending Maduro.
Well, you know, if it walks like a dictator and talks like a dictator and postpones elections that could threaten its power like a dictator and kidnaps its opponents in the night like a dictator, I'm sorry, but it's a dictator. The shoe fits here.
Yeah, well, there's no question about that. I mean, the unimaginable suffering of these people here is also going to create thousands of new refugees at a time where we've got a refugee crisis in the Middle East. We've got a policy in the United States that's becoming increasingly less friendly to those who would hope to become migrants into the U.S., immigrants. You've got, you know, the refugee situation by itself is potentially alarming when you're considering a nation of 30 million people and a Marxist dictator such as Maduro, who's already jailed hundreds of political opponents, now is jailing more, sending out a clear signal by arresting his political opponents after dragging them out of bed in the middle of the night. I mean, the potential for a flood of refugees coming not just from the Middle East, but also from South America, is it real?
Well, the situation of Venezuela, if it doesn't improve soon, has the potential to destabilize the region. And I'm just going to say it right now, because you have a population of 30 million people that can't afford to buy bread. They can't afford to eat. You know, they're on that Maduro diet, as we say. So if Venezuela goes any further into the death spiral that it's already going, those people are going to pack up and leave. And it'll take them a while to get here, but that's going to destabilize the region. You're going to have exactly what you're seeing, you know, in Europe and parts of the Middle East, where you have all of these refugees that the surrounding countries have to deal with, and that's going to put an economic strain on those countries, many of which are strategic partners of ours, which is going to cause us problems. So there's second and third order effects. You know, if this was happening in Mexico or Canada, the threat of those specific Venezuelan refugees, you know, coming to us would be a little greater. But what we have to look at, and especially when we look at foreign policy, and especially when we look at, you know, strategic issues, it's the second and third order effects that we have to look at. And if Venezuela doesn't improve soon, there's going to be a host of those that we can't even fathom what they're going to be right now, but they're not going to be good.
How close is Venezuela to outright civil war?
You know, I don't know if I'm comfortable giving a real estimate on that, but what I can tell you is that, you know, this is not the first time that they've had these types of protests. You know, we had food shortages in 2014 under Chavez, but the protests that we have currently, they're getting bad because, you know, even during the constituent election, you know, you had protesters and activists that were, you know, setting up barricades, and then there was scuffle with police. There was a bomb that went off in Caracas, you know, that injured police. About a dozen or so people were killed. I don't know how much more the Venezuelan people can take, but I can tell you right now is they are incredibly patient if they haven't gone to civil war yet. So if the situation doesn't improve, we very well may see it, but it's only going to get worse from here.
I mean, you've got pretty much unchecked violence in the streets, right? You've got a curfew where people can't go out after 5 p.m., and they're pretty much mostly afraid to go out before 5 p.m., to go out almost any time, because there's total anarchy in the streets, it appears.
You know, the only thing, I think, in my opinion, the only thing that has kept Venezuela from going into all-out civil war currently is that the opposition is actually trying to remain democratic. You know, the National Assembly, which is their version of the Congress, is controlled by the opposition, and they have done everything they can to make the situation right through democratic means. They've tried to host, you know, have referendums for, you know, election to remove Maduro. You know, they've tried to boycott this current constituent assembly election. They even had a referendum to determine whether or not people even wanted it. And the turnout for those that voted that they didn't want an election was greater than the turnout of those that actually showed up for the constituent assembly election.
Right.
So the opposition has been trying everything they can to remain democratic, which, I mean, kudos to them, because, you know, if anything, to another civil war or another coup, the only thing that we're going to see is more violence. But, you know, there are rumblings and there are rumors that, you know, a coup is on the rise. It even came up in a recent press briefing, you know, if the United States will support a coup, you know, that happens, which, of course, you know, the White House officials didn't really give an answer on it. But, I mean, I don't know if we're going to have a full civil war. I think we'll have a coup before then, because the military's got to eat, too.
All right. Thank you. Nathan, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. Thanks for having me.
Nathan Steelwater, military and foreign affairs correspondent for LibertyNation.com. I'm Tim Donner, and this is the podcast of LibertyNation.com, The Uprising.